Nobody can be too Jewish.
That's exactly it. You got it.
Shalom and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Bart Ehrman, best-selling author of Heaven and Hell, A History of the Afterlife. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, our Mevina on Israel, Imbal Shtivi, and our Shin Shinim, our young representatives of Israel, Shai Friedwald and Danielle Levy. Please email your comments to us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at 2JewishRadio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and 2 Jewish.
Shalom. While all radio stations and all television stations and the entire internet and all social media seem to be about the coronavirus 24 hours a day, 7 days a week right now, we here at 2 Jewish have decided to actually focus on something else, at least partially, for a few minutes today. We want to talk about Passover this morning, Pesach, the great festival of freedom, the celebration of the liberation of our people from slavery in Egypt. On the first and often the second nights of Passover, we hold a wonderful ritual meal, a Pesach Seder, in which we invite our relatives and friends over to read and sing the Haggadah, eat a ton of stuff, and tell the story of servitude, bondage, and redemption. This is a great time of year in the springtime. We often welcome as many people into our homes and especially our synagogues for Seder as we possibly can accommodate. I've had Seders in my home for as many as 36 people, a very Jewish number, two times chai, and our very first congregational Seder at my own synagogue, Congregation Beit Simcha, here in Tucson, Arizona, where I live, was held last year. We expected maybe 40 people. We ended up with 107. You know, it's great to have lots of people for Seder. There's a crucial moment in the Pesach Seder when we say aloud, Kol dichfin yetzei v'yechol. Let all who are hungry come and eat. And we mean it. It's typical for anyone who has nowhere to go to be invited to join a Passover Seder. Well, in the Passover Seder, the first two nights of Pesach, by the way, are coming up April 8th and 9th, the main thematic statement is, B'chol dor v'dor chayav adam lirot et atzmo ke'ilu hu yatzam mitzrayim, which means, in every generation, each of us must see ourselves as though we personally came out of Egypt. And we welcome everyone to join us in fulfilling this great mitzvah. This year will be weird. Because if you're not supposed to have more than 10 people in one place at a time, well, that makes a typical Passover Seder completely impossible for a lot of us. I mean, Passover is the exact opposite of social distancing. On the other hand, there's almost nothing in Judaism more important than the sanctity of human life. We protect that at nearly all costs. So this will be a Passover season of virtual Pesach for many people, and the normal experience of a large Seder is unlikely to occur, at least at its normal time frame. We Jews have a kind of internalized understanding of how the original Exodus and our subsequent enforced wanderings entered into our souls. Israeli poet Amnon Rybak said it beautifully in his poem Kol Adam Tzarich Mitzrayim, everyone needs Egypt. Everyone needs his own personal Egypt, the poem goes, to be Moses himself in the midst of it with a strong hand or gritted teeth. Everyone needs terror and great darkness and comfort and security and salvation to know how to lift his eyes to heaven. Everyone needs one prayer that will always be on his lips. A man needs to surrender once. Everyone needs a shoulder. Everyone needs his own personal Egypt to redeem himself from the house of bondage, to leave at midnight into the wilderness of fears, to stride straight into the midst of the waters, to see them open before him on both sides. Everyone needs a shoulder to lift up the bones of Jacob. Everyone needs to straighten. Everyone needs his own personal Egypt and Jerusalem and one long journey to remember forever in his feet. Amnon Rybak's great poem, Everyone Needs Egypt. In a way, this year we'll experience a little bit of servitude on Pesach. Some of us are stuck in quarantine or home lockdown, and who knows how exactly it'll be by then. How we reinterpret this experience may give us greater insight into just what it meant for our ancestors to be enslaved, how others who are enslaved struggle for freedom, and how we can grow from this strange, strange year, this strange experience. Providing some comedy relief during this very serious time and play us in this morning, here's the completely ridiculous and quite wonderful cut from past two Jewish guests, Sean Altman. It's called They Tried to Kill Us, We Survived, Let's Eat. This is the silliest Passover song of all, perhaps. Lord knows we need a little funny right now.
We were slaves to Pharaoh in Egypt. The year was 1492. Hitler had just invaded Poland. Madonna had just become a Jew. Moses was found on the Potomac. Then he marched with Martin Luther King. He came back to free us from our bondage. 'Cause S&M has never been our thing. They tried to kill us, we survived, let's eat. They tried to kill us, we were faster on our feet. So they chase us to the border, there's a parting of the water. Tried to kill us, we survived, let's eat. Then the Pharaoh, who looked like Yul Brynner, heard the Jews were trying to escape. Charlton Heston came right down from the mountain. He said, Pharaoh, you're a damn dirty ape. The menorah was almost out of oil. Farrakhan was planning Kristallnacht. The gefilte was nearing extinction. It looked like Moses and his flock were verkocht. They tried to kill us, we survived, let's eat. They tried to kill us, we were faster on our feet. But we knew how to resist, 'cause we'd read in Schindler's List. Tried to kill us, we survived, let's eat.
The 10 Egyptian plagues.
One.
Blood.
No.
Locusts.
Three.
Boils.
Four.
Dandruff.
Five.
Acne.
Six.
Bacne.
Seven.
Piles.
Eight.
Cataracts.
Nine.
Sciatica.
Ten.
Sickle cell anemia.
We fled on foot, there was no time to tarry. Leavening the bread would take too long. All we had was egg foo young and matzah while battling the fearsome Viet Cong.
I'm Korean.
Sure you are.
And so tonight we gather to remember the ancient Hebrews who paid the price. We have a Seder each year in December to commemorate our Savior Jesus Christ.
Sorry I'm late.
They tried to kill us, we survived, let's eat. They tried to kill us, we were faster on our feet. So we never did succumb to the annual pogrom. Tried to kill us, we survived, let's eat.
Let's eat.
They tried to kill us, we survived, let's eat.
Let's eat.
They tried to kill us, we were faster on our feet. So come on, blow the shofar, 'cause they haven't nailed us so far. Tried to kill us, we survived, let's eat.
That was the remarkable Sean Altman's They Tried to Kill Us, We Survived, Let's Eat. Please, do not use that song as a guide on how to do your own Seder. When we return in a moment on To Jewish, our guest, Professor Bart Ehrman, the New York Times best-selling author of a number of books on religion and early Christianity, will explore his brand new book, Heaven and Hell, A History of the Afterlife. Meet him when we come back in a moment on To Jewish. Find out the most surprising thing about what happens in the next world when we return.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun. A place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol. The best games in town. Amazing dining and top flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson.
Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball.
Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Congregation Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a new Jewish synagogue in northwest Tucson in the Catalina foothills, celebrates a great array of services, classes, and events this spring. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha has created a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. A new progressive congregation in northwest Tucson and the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Beit Simcha's synagogue is located at 2270 West Ina Road, just west of La Cholla, near the entrance to the Foothills Mall property. Services, classes, and events are open to all during normal times. In these days of coronavirus tsaros, join us every Friday night on our Facebook page for Shabbat evening celebration services at 6:30 p.m. Saturday morning Torah study will be at 9 a.m., followed by Shabbat morning services at 10 a.m., all with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, leading them. Our Facebook page is Beit Simcha Tucson, Beit Simcha Tucson, and we will be holding our services with full music and a very small minyan by virtual experience weekly for the time being. Our synagogue is located at 2270 West Ina Road, west of La Cholla on the north side of Ina, at the entrance to the Foothills Mall in our own building there. For more information about Congregation Beit Simcha, to attend services on our Facebook page, and to go to all of our classes also on Facebook, our great religious school and Torah text programs will resume when we're allowed to do so. Bar and Bat Mitzvah are being taught by virtual experience. Confirmation and high school programs similarly. Well, boy, it's such an interesting time. Anyway, everything being streamed on our Facebook page. Of course, all of our services. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org. For more information, call 520-276-5675. That's 276-5675 or BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, in the newest Jewish community in southern Arizona and the fastest-growing congregation in all of Arizona in its exciting beginning years. We are delighted to welcome to Two Jewish our guest this morning. Bart Ehrman is, oh boy, certainly one of the leading authorities on the New Testament and the history of early Christianity, the author or editor of over 30 books. He's a lazy guy, actually, if you come right down to it, including the New York Times bestsellers Misquoting Jesus, How Jesus Became God, The Triumph of Christianity, distinguished professor of religious studies at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. He has also created a number of popular audio-video courses for the Great Courses series. His new book is called Heaven and Hell, A History of the Afterlife. And, well, it's a fascinating topic. Good morning and welcome to Two Jewish.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So why did you decide to probe the realm behind the curtain in this book?
Well, two reasons. One was personal. I was raised a very conservative evangelical Christian who fully believed in heaven and hell, and thought I was going to one and most everyone else was going to the other. And when I ended up losing my faith, I started doubting, you know, oh my God, what if I'm wrong, you know? And so early on, I got interested in it. More recently, as a scholar, I'm no longer a Christian, but I am a scholar of the New Testament and early Christianity, and I became increasingly interested the more I realized how important it was to most people around the world, including America, where it turns out the majority of people still believe in a literal heaven and a literal hell. And so I thought I'd look into where these ideas originally came from.
So I want to work into this backwards a little bit. You can make a case that Christianity cares more about the afterlife than it does in this life. How did that become so central in the evolution of Christianity?
It's absolutely right. I mean, it's down till today. I mean, most of my students here in Chapel Hill, the only reason they'd be religious at all is because they're afraid of burning in hell or they want to go to heaven. And it does start out very early in Christianity. One of the things I argue in this book is that it was not what Jesus himself taught, or the Apostle Paul, or the Book of Revelation, and that it was a later development within Christianity. that developed in part because Christians wanted to explain to themselves how it was fair for them to suffer so badly by persecutions or martyrdoms when all these wicked folk didn't suffer at all. And the explanation, of course, was, well, they're going to get it in the end, and we're going to be rewarded.
The evolution of life after death is fascinating. It's kind of strange to talk about it that way, though, isn't it?
It is, and I know, and it's strange to talk about it, and in a sense, in kind of a strange sense, a stranger sense, it's an invention. You know, there was a time when nobody thought that when you died, you would go one place or the other, and then there was a time when everybody seemed to think that, and so somebody came up with the idea, and the issue in my book is, who came up with the idea, and when did they come up with it, and you know, why did they come up with it?
And we will explore that when we come back in just a couple moments with our wonderful guest this morning, Professor, is it okay to call you that? Bart Ehrman. We'll be back in just a moment on Too Jewish.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, a kvetch or a kvel, please email us at TooJewishRadio18@gmail.com. That's TOOJewishRadio18@gmail. Or visit our website at TooJewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, TooJewishRadio.com. Streaming us from there or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store is a very popular Jewish podcast. Top 10 in North America, according to Moment magazine. By the way, this is a great time to catch up on past two Jewish shows. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Last week we began speaking about one of the guest speakers at AIPAC, the AIPAC conference a couple weeks ago, who is the president of Serbia, which is supposedly warming relations with Israel now. That's why they invited him. But he was actually the minister of information in the Serbian government when they perpetrated the horrifying genocidal massacre at Srebrenica of Bosnian Muslims during the war. Maybe you can continue some thoughts on that.
Right. And the point that's so terrible about this is Vucic is completely unrepentant. He's never agreed with calling that a genocide. He's never said it was wrong. He basically maintains that it was justified, time of war, blah, blah, blah. I don't know. These were innocent civilians.
Yeah, it wasn't that they captured an army and killed everybody.
No,
bad enough.
In many ways, it was like Babi Yar, you know, taking them to a ravine and shooting them and filling the hole with their bodies. Now, you could argue, well, it was only 9,000. 9,000 is a lot of human beings.
Oh, my God.
And every human life has value and is sacred. Everyone is created in the image of God. It doesn't matter to me whether there were 9 or 9,000. This guy has blood on his hands, and he's unrepentant. So why give him a welcome at AIPAC? There are lots of other speakers you could have. There are probably worse political figures in Europe, but not necessarily people who are guilty of genocide and have blood on their hands. And I found completely incomprehensible and unacceptable that this guy was given a role to play at an event that's supposed to be about America's relationship with Israel. Why do we need the Serbian president there, especially one with such a god-awful past? Now, let me add quickly that I think the whole Bosnian War, the civil war in the former Yugoslavia, whatever you want to call it, but the war that included this one particular egregious example of genocide is a war that's very poorly understood by the American public, in part because it was poorly covered by our journalists. And there's a reason for that, which is that everything in the Balkans is overly complicated. It's
yes.
All lots of shades of gray, and you have to know this part of history and that part of history and a part of history even before that. And it's extremely hard in any Balkan conflict to find white hats and black hats and be reasonable about that. Everybody's wearing a gray hat. And American journalists don't like that because it's not simple, it's not quick, it's not a soundbite, especially broadcast journalists. But even print journalists, there were a couple who did a good job covering the Bosnian War, but they weren't widely read. And I think most Americans have very little understanding of really how awful this war was and why there's a war crimes tribunal still in The Hague for war crimes committed by Serbs during this war.
And it would, you would think that a people that has experienced genocide, quite likely the worst genocide in human history, the Jews, would know better than to invite someone who was intimately tied with genocide to come and speak at an important conference.
Right. You'd think our historical memory would serve us better. And just to be clear about one thing before we wrap up, lest any of your listeners think that I dislike Serbs, literally some of my best friends are Serbs. And I have to say that Serbs
are
among...
That's actually true. I've met
right,
some. So.
Serbs are among the most hospitable people in the world. They can be wonderfully welcoming to strangers. They are gracious. They are generous. They are certainly not all in favor of genocide. They're certainly not all brutal. But they had a government which planned and executed some pretty awful things in the 90s. And not all those people have been purged from political life.
Thanks so much, Tom. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
We welcome our Mivina on Israel, the Shlichah, the representative of the One Trib Israel Center, Boker Tov Inbal.
Boker Tov all.
So the Israeli elections, this was the third national election in less than a year, and there have been some changes and a whole lot of similarities. Tell us how the vote came out this time.
So, yeah, definitely a lot of similarities. We're talking about 58 out of 120, yeah, 58 mandates or seats, parliament seats for the entire block of right wing.
Right, so that's Likud plus all the religious parties and the super right party, Yamina and all those. Okay.
Yeah, and not enough seats for the others. So the one thing that is extremely evident, I would say like that, is that out of 120 seats, 15 are taken by the Joint Arab List, which is the compilation of four different Arab parties that have been historically participating in the parliamentary system. And as a result of their coming together for now, it's the fourth time that they have been running together. Okay, so it began before this round of election, and now it's every time they become bigger, they become larger, and they are now the third largest party in the Israeli parliament, which suggests so much about, you know, the structure of the parliament and how should it be, how should decisions be made. Can you, should the parliament not take the Joint Arab List as part of a potential coalition, their citizens, or not, or we say, no, this is something else. It's a big, big, big situation in Israel. This discussion is extremely important now. It has always been there, and now it proves that they are the third largest party.
Yeah, it's kind of amazing, actually, isn't it?
And it's not all the same. There are the more communist, civic oriented one, and there is a party there who is less inclined, I would say, to be part of the Israeli, agenda, kind of. So, but there are four of them.
Would you qualify them as anti-Zionist, these Arab parties?
That's a big question. It's a big, big question. I am not sure I'm qualified to answer that. It goes a little bit beyond. If I define someone like this or like that, it asks a question about nationality in general. Do other minorities around the world, are they anti wherever they are based? Are they for? Does it matter? Does it even matter? That's the question.
Well, if they're not in power, it sort of doesn't, does it?
And I think that by posing such a question immediately narrows the conversation in a way that is not beneficial for either of the parties.
Sure.
Well,
a fascinating situation, and I must say we have no idea what will come out of it yet. Thanks so much, and we'll talk next week.
It's time for our 2020 presidential election from a Jewish perspective segment. Amidst the overwhelming focus on coronavirus, the presidential election has just about disappeared from view. Still, last week, Joe Biden won three more Democratic primaries, leading to calls for Bernie Sanders, the only remaining Jewish candidate to pull out of the race. Biden and Sanders appeared in a debate held without a live audience in Washington, D.C., and while Sanders was, as expected, the more articulate of the two, both performed pretty well, it actually looked like they could cooperate in the eventual final election campaign against Donald Trump. As far as the Jewish vote for president is concerned, it is my expectation that it will tend to follow the last, 28 years of presidential voting in America. In every election since 1992, the Democratic nominee has won between 69% and 80% of the Jewish vote. Bill Clinton was near the top of that curve, winning about 80% of the Jewish votes in his two successful presidential elections. Hillary Clinton was closer to the bottom of that curve, still taking 71% of the Jewish votes in 2016. However, the difference between 71% and 80% can be significant. For example, it's possible that if Hillary Clinton had polled as well as her husband did in Florida and Pennsylvania, she, not Donald Trump, would have become president. Interesting news for, well, what looks like Joe Biden. That was our 2020 presidential election from a Jewish perspective update. It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Two old Jewish men are chatting. Abe says to Moshe, "How are things? What do you do to keep busy?" "Funny you should ask," Abe answers Moshe. "Mein doctor told me that I needed to have a hobby, so I took up a hobby." "Said so, Moshe. That's great. Tell me, what's your new hobby?" Moshe says, "I keep bees." "Oh," says Abe, "does that mean you catch bees and put them in a jar?" And Moshe says, "That's right. I catch bees in a glass jar. I put them in the jar with a screw on top. That's my hobby." "Oh," says Abe, "so do you poke holes in the top of the jar so the bees can breathe?" "No," says Moshe, "that I don't do." "But they must die then," objects Abe. "So they die," says Moshe. "It's only a hobby." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish just for you. You should live and be well and develop a hobby. And now a word of Torah. This week we begin the middle book of the Torah, Leviticus. The Hebrew name comes from its first word, Vayikra, God called. There's a famous idiosyncrasy about the Aleph, the last Hebrew letter in the word Vayikra, as it's written in the Torah, because it's written smaller than the other letters. Aleph, the Midrash tells us, is the first letter of the word Ani, I. Therefore, if we wish God to call us directly, we must diminish our focus on I and seek to limit our egotism. If we can do that, then we, like Moses, will be able to clearly hear God's call, to respond and so find the holiness that makes up the central subject of the book of Leviticus. Less of the I, me, and more of God. Very nice interpretation. But there's something puzzling about this midrash. If Moses, our great leader, was truly the humblest man in the world, just how did he have the ego strength to lead an enormously fractious group of Jews across a wilderness to the promised land, often against their will? How could anyone so humble and modest manage to lead such a people through all the trials and tribulations described in the Torah? Perhaps the secret lies in the inner strength that comes only from faith. Faced with the vicissitudes of life and the challenges and demands of a world that is very far from wholeness, our own arrogance cannot carry us to any promised land we seek. But trust in a God who implants within each of us a spark of the divine, a core element of holiness we can draw upon at times of crisis, well, that can bring us to a better place. Moses realized that he himself was unfit for the task that God assigned him, and so he was indeed humble. But he also knew that the God he believed in and whose mitzvot he followed was infinitely powerful and profoundly holy. If he, a fallible human being, simply placed his confidence and trust in God, he would ultimately succeed. So too for us. We can't really do it alone, however we define it. But if we place our faith in God and know that God can and will help, we may become like Moses, humble but holy and ultimately successful. When we return on To Jewish, our guest, New York Times bestselling author Bart Ehrman, explores heaven and hell in Jewish belief, how it influenced all other ways of thinking about life after death. Learn the secrets of the afterlife right here when we come back on To Jewish, or at least what people think those secrets are and were, in just a moment.
We continue with our To Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Israel's Sephardic chief rabbi Yitzchak Yosef issued a ruling last week that religious Jews must leave their cell phones turned on during Shabbat in order to receive coronavirus updates, in order that the Israeli health ministry can immediately inform people they may have been exposed to the virus and must be in quarantine. That marks a significant break with Jewish law, halacha, but it does so with the awareness that the only circumstances that set aside the laws of Shabbat are those related to pikuach nefesh, the saving of life. Surely this qualifies. Israel has completely closed its borders now to all foreign nationals, effective immediately. Prior to the declaration, travelers who are neither citizens nor residents could enter only if they could prove they had a place to self-isolate for 14 days. Not anymore, not for the foreseeable future. In Great Britain, the chief rabbi Ephraim Mervis ordered the closure of all synagogues affiliated with United Synagogue, the largest network of Orthodox shuls in the country. Until last week, the UK had not advocated social distancing. Houses of worship remained open. Not no mo. The leaders of the conservative movement's Jewish Law Committee here in America issued a crisis declaration allowing the recitation of the Mourner's Kaddish with a virtual online prayer quorum, a minyan. My Jewish Learning has launched a virtual minyan for those looking for the chance to recite Mourner's Kaddish. The Rabbinical Council of Australia and New Zealand last week called on all synagogues to close their doors for social and religious gatherings, including services, the Australian Jewish News reported. With gatherings limited to 10 people in Israel, Israelis sought creative ways to include family and friends in their weddings. A photo making the rounds on social media shows an unnamed couple being married in the aisle of a supermarket. Since the limit on the number of people who can be in a supermarket in Israel at any given time is 100 instead of just 10. People are still visiting the Kotel, the Western Wall, but Rabbi Shmuel Rabinowitz, the rabbi of the Western Wall and other holy sites, called on worshippers not to kiss the stones of the Kotel to avoid spreading coronavirus. Boy, is that good advice. Worshippers at the Kotel have begun standing about 6 feet apart during prayer services in areas marked by yellow tape that can be occupied by no more than a minyan, 10 people overall. And the coronavirus crisis is delaying Israeli Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu's corruption trial. That trial had been set to begin this week, just as Netanyahu's negotiating to form a government in the wake of this month's elections. And in news that seems irrelevant now, but may have very serious implications, Israeli Knesset Speaker Yuli Edelstein adjourned the Israeli parliament, the Knesset, for 5 days, citing the need for talks on a unity government in a move his critics call undemocratic. Edelstein made the announcement after his Likud party and its chief rival, Kahol Lavan, Blue and White, were unable to reach a compromise on the formation of Knesset committees. The committees are necessary to run the Knesset. Blue and White, whose head Benny Gantz has been tasked with forming a new government following elections earlier this month, wants to use one of those committees to replace Edelstein as Speaker. Edelstein, who has served in the post since 2013, refused to hold a vote that would have named his successor. That way he gets to stay. Gantz said that Blue-White plans to petition the Israeli Supreme Court on the matter. No crisis, whatever its scope, may be exploited as a means to trample upon values of national decorum and responsibility and to undermine the will of the voting public, said Gantz. Likud lacks a majority in the Knesset. It has gone ahead and closed it. We won't allow that. At issue is the Arrangements Committee, which oversees the formation and operation of the Knesset. The committee is usually formed through the agreement of the Knesset's parties. Likud has said that the Arrangements Committee and the committees that it forms cannot have more than 10 members due to Health Ministry coronavirus restrictions, and that neither the right nor left should have a majority among those 10. President Reuven Rivlin called on Edelstein and urged him to reopen the Knesset. A Knesset that's out of action harms the ability of the State of Israel to function well and responsibly in an emergency, Rivlin told Edelstein. We must not let this crisis, serious as it is, harm our democratic system. Edelstein told Rivlin that he was working to resolve the dispute. He called on Likud and Blue and White to reach an immediate understanding about the establishment of Knesset committees. The gaps between the sides are not great, Edelstein said. Israeli citizens deserve their elected representatives to work for them and oversee the work of the government. There's no reason to drag this out. Netanyahu said he would safeguard democracy in Israel. I certainly hope so. Prime Minister, who has led a caretaker government for about a year, said that while he is managing the battle against the coronavirus, some only want to overthrow a prime minister who is on guard against the virus. Hoo-ha. This is the time to demonstrate national responsibility, Bibi said. We can and must form a government. And, you know, maybe use non-democratic means to do so. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews around the world.
We welcome back to Two Jewish, our guest this morning. Bart Ehrman is the distinguished professor of, a distinguished professor of religious studies, University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. He's the leading authority on the New Testament and the early history and development of Christianity, author and editor of more than 30 books, including a number of New York Times bestsellers, including Misquoting Jesus, How Jesus Became God, The Triumph of Christianity. His new book is called Heaven and Hell, A History of the Afterlife. It actually reads like a novel, which is a good thing to say about a scholarly book. So I'm going to jump to the Jewish sources on the afterlife. I'm teaching a class right now, Life After Death in Jewish Belief. I always love teaching this class because nobody can prove me wrong. And nobody wants to do the research. there's some advantages to writing about that. But in the certainly there's no mention of life after death in the first five books in the Torah at all in Judaism. And then sometime in the prophetic period, ideas begin to creep in. Can you talk about that process a little bit?
Right. You know, it's as you know, it's much debated issue about views of the afterlife in parts of the Hebrew Bible. My sense is that the oldest views, of course, are you get views of Sheol as a place. Yeah, whether it's a place where people go to, like a Greek Hades, or if it's just the grave, is a debated issue. I personally don't think that it's like a location, you know, that everybody goes to and sort of hangs out for eternity. I think it's a synonym for the grave. So there's that.
I always love the fact that it's the same letters in Hebrew as Sha'al, which is a question.
Well, that's right, and there are debates about the etymology. You know, does it come from that? You know, from the question. You know, the issue of question and asking and such. It's debated among linguists, but it definitely could be that. But that's not an afterlife in the way that people, you know, tend to think about it in terms of, you know, actually having some kind of personal long-term existence. The place it starts showing up the most appears to be after the exile, when you have prophets who are predicting that the nation is going to come back to life. And so you get hints of resurrection language for example, in Isaiah, and especially Ezekiel 37. Some people think that these hints about the resurrection of the nation eventually transformed into the resurrection of individuals, which you don't get definitively, of course, until Daniel chapter 12, which is probably the last book of the Hebrew Bible to be written.
Last one that's written.
You know, it's a fascinating idea because there's quite a lot about the revival of the corporate, the whole body of the people of Israel. We just kind of think it drifted into the individual?
I don't think it drifted. I think what happened was you have someone like Ezekiel that's trying to explain, how God could allow the nation to die at the hands of the Babylonians. And, you know, the leaders have been exiled, and there's no Israel there, basically. And God says that that he's going to bring them back to the land, and he's going to raise them from the dead as a nation, that the nation will be restored. And then years later, probably, it's usually thought that it was during the Maccabean Revolt, when people were suffering now, people in Israel, Jews were suffering, not because they were violating the law of God, but because they were keeping it. And so when the Syriac monarch Antiochus Epiphanes wanted to Hellenize the Promised Land, there was a revolt, obviously, and there were Jews who were tortured to death precisely because they refused to eat pork, or they would insist on circumcising their children. And at that point, I think people started thinking more on the individual level, like, you know, why am I personally being tortured for doing what's right? And that's when the idea comes in that God must be going to vindicate me the way he vindicated the nation.
So that's the notion of physical bodily resurrection. Where does the idea that we have an eternal soul come from originally?
Well, that's exactly right, because the Jewish idea, the original Jewish idea, is that it's the body that comes back to life, and the soul doesn't exist apart from the body. It actually comes in from Greek thought. The earliest representations we have of this are in Greek thought, most famously in Plato. Who taught the immortality of the soul and taught that the body would die and corrupt and disappear, but the soul would live on forever. And what ends up happening is that this Greek way of looking at things starts creeping into, in a big time, it creeps into Christianity, but it creeps into Judaism in places as well. And so you do get Jewish texts that also talk about souls that are surviving after death, apparently without their bodies. And then in Christianity, that gets taken up and the Christians run with it.
So the first century was a pretty weird time in Israel. A lot of things were going wrong. There's kind of a synthesis of these two ideas, but everybody's focused on life after death. It feels like all the different cults, all the different sects going on.
It looks like most of them are, and the one that is not, at least according. I mean, it's really hard to know about these different sects in the first century because we don't have any writings from most of them. But the Sadducees, in particular, at least, were famous for denying the resurrection of the dead, in opposition to Pharisees and Essenes and others. But they're the only group we know of. I mean, it appears that the majority of people subscribe to this idea of a future resurrection, and that there would be it'd be a bodily existence. It's not that your soul is going to be brought to life. Your body's going to be brought to life, and it's going to live on in a bodily existence.
But the ideas sort of coalesce at some point, where the soul gets reimplanted in the body, and it turns eventually into this sort of classic notion of a judgment day and all the rest of it.
That's right. It's an interesting development, because originally the oldest idea we can trace is that the soul is really more like we might think of as the breath today. When a person stops breathing,
neshima in Hebrew, that's
yeah,
the word,
that's right.
Okay.
You stop breathing, and when you stop breathing, your body dies, but the breath doesn't go anywhere. It doesn't have an independent existence. It just stops, and that was more the understanding of what sometimes gets translated as soul in the Old Testament, is that it's the thing that makes the body alive. It's not a separate existence. But as soon as Greek thought starts creeping in, which it did almost everywhere because the whole world had Hellenistic influence by this time, the Western world, then all of a sudden this breath idea comes to be its own thing, and you have souls that it can exist apart from the body, and then it's the soul coming back into the body, the soul that had existed outside of it now comes back in, and the person is then raised.
A number of the texts that are our earliest sources are apocryphal, an area of your expertise in particular. Not that you don't seem to know pretty much everything, but a lot of these apocryphal texts don't end up being included in the canon. Some do. Can you explore that a little bit? Because a lot of them seem to talk about what happens after we die.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think the reason they get excluded is simply that most of them were written beyond the period after which people had decided what was going to be scripture. Although, as you know, there are big debates about all that. But the idea of afterlife does become far more prominent after the Hebrew Bible, and in some very interesting books. I mean, there are some of them we have preserved fairly well, like the book of First Enoch has Enoch going on a tour of the heavens, and he actually sees the places where souls are waiting for the last judgment. In different kind of locations.
And when would you date that?
This part of First Enoch is called the Book of the Watchers. So it's the first 36 chapters of Enoch. Enoch has a number of books in it that were written at different times. And this one is probably written at the end of the 3rd century BCE.
So 2,200 years ago. I mean, pretty
old. Yeah, pretty old. It's actually older than the Book of Daniel.
Yeah, even though Daniel made it into the Bible.
Daniel made it in, yeah.
It was a tough cut.
Yeah, it was a tough cut. But Daniel was thought to have been written in the 6th century BCE, and so they say, well, okay,
yeah, well, it isn't really, but we can pretend it was written
right,
in Babylonian times. Okay.
Right. So there's that, and then there are a number of these apocalypses. One of the most interesting is called the Apocalypse of Zechariah, which is a book about somebody who's actually sees the torments of the damned in suffering in a kind of a hell, kind of a fires of hell place. And it's sometimes thought that this apocalypse of Zechariah was influential on later Christian texts, where you have Christians who are Christian apostles who are taken on tours of heaven and hell to see the blessings of those who are saved and the torments of the damned. And it may be that this originated in the Judeo-Christian, the Jewish and Christian traditions because of these older Jewish texts.
Yeah, it's funny, kind of culminating in Dante much later.
That's right, it is. And you know, Dante, people think of Dante's coming up with this idea of these tours, but actually he's dependent on much older traditions.
The notion that my favorite quote about life after death in the Talmud says, those who don't believe in the world to come have no share in it. I always think that's totally fair,
right?
It does seem fair, yeah.
When did it become doctrinal for so many religions that there was a life after death and that you had a judgment and all of this was
reward and punishment stuff?
Well, the idea of judgment comes in with apocalyptic Judaism, so probably the 2nd century, around the time of Daniel, is when it starts coming in. And it becomes, as we said, a very dominant view, because it's based on a theodicy, that God, if God is just, there has to be a judgment, you know, and people have to get what they deserve. And so it became common in Judaism.
We solved that problem of, you know, bad things happening to good people, good things happening to bad people.
Exactly. And it explains it, and to the satisfaction of people for thousands of years now, that you know, it's going to all happen after we die, since it obviously doesn't happen here. And it became the idea of judgment and the resurrection of the body is the view that Jesus himself inherited. So he didn't believe that the soul went to heaven or hell. He thought that there was going to be eternal life on earth for the chosen people who were faithful to God. And it was only really after, at the very end of the New Testament period, at the end of the first century, that anybody started thinking that, in fact, there could be some kind of interim state where people would enjoy some kind of blessings and some kinds of punishment right after death. That eventually became the standard doctrine, because the Christian idea that there would be a last judgment was that it was supposed to happen very soon, and it didn't happen soon at all. And as time dragged on, they started transferring the idea that it's going to happen at the end to that it's going to happen at the end of your life.
I've always heard that, I don't know, it's correct that Christians just kept earliest Christians, the ones who believed in Jesus, Judeo-Christians, whatever you want to call them, kept waiting for Jesus to come back and for this final thing to happen. And then when it didn't happen, then they wrote down the Gospels, or they started to write down their records and began to come up with other theological stuff. Do you think that's really true?
I think it's partially true, yeah. I mean, I do think that they were expecting it to happen imminently. It didn't happen, and it made them transform how they understood the teachings of Jesus and their own understandings of God and the world. I don't know that that's the reason they started writing Gospels. It's a plausible idea, because the idea would be that, you know, early on there'd be no reason to write down the words in Jesus for posterity, because there's not going to be a posterity.
But, if it's all over, why are you writing it down?
Exactly. But then when they start realizing, well, actually, you know, this may take a while, then they think, yeah, okay, we need it. So that part's absolutely possible, although I don't think there's any way to know. But it is certainly true that they expected it to happen right away. It didn't happen. And that changed their views about things.
So, a personal question. You've talked about here on the show and many other contexts your loss of faith, your movement away from being first an evangelical Christian to a liberal Christian to not a Christian. Do you find yourself in an interesting place since you are so deeply immersed in teaching religious studies?
It's terrific. And, you know, the thing is, people kind of get puzzled by it. You know, why would you teach the Bible if you don't believe the Bible? And in a university context, I mean, that makes sense in broader society, but that doesn't really make any sense in a university context. You know, I've got colleagues who teach, you know, they teach Marxism, but they're not communists, you know, or, you know, people.
Teaching the Iliad, but they're not classic Greek people.
They're not Greeks, right? You know, or they can teach about Plato without being Platonists. And so, you know, I've got colleagues who teach Buddhism, but they're not Buddhists. They're just, you know, they know about Buddhism.
Right.
And so I'm somebody who knows about Christianity, and so that's what I teach in a university.
Well, you know, I just have to say, we would take you. There's plenty of Jews who don't believe in God and who question everything. Most of my congregation, I think, most of the time. But
yeah, no, I actually strongly considered it at one time.
I want to thank Bart Ehrman for a fabulous visit here on Too Jewish. The book is called Heaven and Hell, A History of the Afterlife. Highly recommend it. Where can people go to find out more about you, more about the book?
You know, the best place to find out about me is I have a blog. It's called the Bart Ehrman Blog. And if they just Google that, they will find me. And this is a blog that I post on five times a week about New Testament, Jesus, early Christianity, but also Judaism and Hebrew Bible. And so it's a very informative site. And that's the best place.
You'll note I didn't say where can people go to find out more about life after death, because they'll find out.
We know that.
Find that out soon enough. Thanks again.
Okay, thank you so much.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol. The best games in town, amazing dining, and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Remember, you could always listen to Too Jewish. No danger of coronavirus infection. Join us next Sunday on Too Jewish. Our guest will be Ambassador and Rabbi David Saperstein, President of the World Union for Progressive Judaism. Our playout this morning comes from the Maccabees, a medley of different musical approaches to Dayenu for the coming festival of Passover, reaching us in just 2.5 weeks. You know, my favorite comment on this Dayenu medley was, I showed my friend this song and she said, "Who's Enu? Why does he have to die?" I died at that moment of laughter. We hope nobody dies from Dayenu or matzah or coronavirus. May this bizarre time of virus, quarantine, fear, and social distancing end soon. May we perhaps be able to truly celebrate the coming festival of freedom in joy. My friends, may you have a healthy week. God willing, a Shavua Tov and a week, we pray, of peace.
Ilu ilu hotzianu, hotzianu mi mitzrayim, hotzianu mi mitzrayim, dayenu. Dayenu, dayenu.
Die, Louie, Coralano, Coralano, and I am Coralano, and I am dying.
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.